Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello. On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to the Opera Company of Philadelphia's upcoming production of Gounod's Romeo and Juliet that casts the Capulets and the Montagues not as feuding families, but as rival fashion houses. And we speak with Charles Croce, the new CEO of Philadelphia City Museum, the newly revamped and renamed Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The fashion world has long been known for its homicidal competitiveness, but can it be tragic on a Shakespearean scale? That's the question raised by the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Gounod's opera Romeo and Juliet, reset in the modern fashion world. Opening on February 11th at the Academy of Music, the Capulets and Montagues will become rival haute couture houses, with lead singers Stephen Costello and Eileen Perez on star-crossed runways. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns now reports from the rehearsal studio.
Is that Ellen Perez pouting behind those white, high-style, Chanel-ish sunglasses? That sweet girl from Chicago who was first heard here at the Academy of Vocal Arts has come a long way to posing for a Vogue-style magazine cover that establishes her as the face of the Capulet Fashion House. That same face is ruthlessly graffitied by those tough, streetwise Montagues. Look out, it's war on the runways. Of course, there are those who wonder if all this is necessary. Isn't Shakespeare's timeless story just fine the way it is? Maybe not. The arranged marriages that drive the plot of Romeo and Juliet are no longer an issue, and now there's even a Disney film about gnomes titled Gnomeo and Juliet. So in the interest of contemporary relevance, director Manfred Schweighöfer followed the money.
I had to find a reason why it would be impossible that Romeo and Juliet could come together. And so I went into economy. It's impossible when you think on a world of economy, and especially when you think on a world of haute couture. And so I love the story that Romeo and Juliet could be not only of two diverse fashion houses, but that Juliet is also the poster on every bus, on every newspaper. That makes really impossible that Juliet could come together with Romeo, because there's a mighty power of economy behind, which could not allow this.
To those not familiar with the fashion world, bringing it to Romeo and Juliet might seem a bit like swathing Shakespeare in cotton candy. Is the fashion world serious enough for this story? Is it dark enough?
Yes, look how many killings were in the fashion world during the last years. I mean, Versace was killed. There is a lot of criminal activity in the fashion world. Is so strong connected to the drug world. I think that the fashion world is a world of power. Who is getting the cover on the important newspapers? Who is getting the best time on the fashion shows?
With most operatic casts, the audience would have to do an awful lot of squinting to imagine the singers as fashion models. Ellen Perez and Stephen Costello, who are a real-life married couple, have no problem being cast in these roles on the strength of their voices, but they're also handsome, even svelte. And nobody's more relieved than costume designer Richard St. Clair.
Sometimes my job is to take some 50-year-old woman and make her look like a 16-year-old virgin, and then I have some 22-year-old hot chick from Curtis playing her mother. And this time, these people are really cast with love to really look like the characters they're playing. I'm so thankful for this cast.
To prepare their look and to shoot the photos that are seen on bus shelters all over Philadelphia, St. Clair visited Perez and Costello this summer in Cincinnati, where they were performing the lead roles in La Bohème.
Dammi il braccio, mia piccina, obbedisco, signor, che m'ami ti.
A fashion photographer and a makeup artist were hired. It was then, according to St. Clair, that Perez revealed hidden sides to her personality.
At this fashion shoot, she was like a model. She worked the dresses, she was working her hair, and I mean, honestly, she just played to the camera the whole time, and the photographer was just like wowed by everything she did in front of the camera. We got amazing pictures.
Now in rehearsals for the production, Perez has to admit she's enjoying the working conditions.
I'm not going to be wearing a corset. And, you know, that also gives us the freedom, just is a liberty of how flexible we can be on stage, how much we can use our body in telling the story, which we train to use our voice to tell a story. And I love having the flexibility to be in modern dress, which what we're used to, and being as expressive conversationally on stage as you might be in real life.
I try to keep them tiny, I try to keep them honest, without doing big opera movements, without doing wrong attitudes. So we try to bring a very theatrical acting into the show.
But do all these trappings change the way Stephen Costello actually sings?
I don't think it affects the way we sing it at all. I mean, it is still opera. You still have to worry about the text, the words, and the music. If, you know, if the production overshadows all that, I mean, what's the point of doing it?
At least, this opera's ballet interludes, which can be so tiresome in a traditional production, are now a fashion show. At the end of the operatic day, the production concept isn't so radical, intrusive, or perverse as much of what happens in the European opera houses these days, or even some of the things that Richard St. Clair has lived through.
You know, sometimes you can see a show that has a concept sort of slathered on the top of it, and it doesn't necessarily fit. Everything that he wants to do with this makes perfect sense. And as it's developed, and we're saying, what if this person was this? And what if this happened? You know, like with different characters and stuff, it all makes sense within the story of Romeo and Juliet. It's not Romeo and Juliet set on Mars.
Now, wait a minute. Romeo and Juliet set on Mars? Well, why not? A few years ago in Zurich, I saw Otello set in a spaceship. Seriously. As the title character goes into his heart of darkness, he heads farther and farther into outer space. It worked for me. In one French opera production I saw, all the characters had doppelgangers in the form of crash dummies. You couldn't have dreamed that. Doesn't that sound clever? Well, novel? At least?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Gounod's Romeo and Juliet opens at the Academy of Music on February 11th and runs through February 20th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Over the course of its nearly 75 years, the Atwater Kent Museum in Philadelphia has acquired the nickname The City's Attic. Its over 100,000 objects collectively tell the story of Philadelphia. Founded in 1938, it took its name from the wealthy industrialist Arthur Atwater Kent. Then Philadelphia Mayor David Wilson and Francis Wistar, president of the Philadelphia Society for the Preservation of Landmarks, wanted to found a city museum and approached Kent to help fund the purchase of a Greek Revival structure on South 7th Street. The building, designed by John Haviland, was being vacated by the Franklin Institute, which was moving to its current site on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. But maintaining such a museum in a city filled with so many blocks of historical significance has not been easy. After years of financial struggles and a low public profile, the Atwater Kent is embarking on a new course with a $5.8 million renovation. For almost a year, the museum has been closed, but has been hosting special programs. Set for a major reopening in March, the museum now has a sharper focus, a more descriptive name, and a new leader. This week I spoke with Charles Croce, former head of communications at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Kimmel Center, and now the executive director of the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. When you came to this job, it was very clear from the get-go that this wasn't about taking over an existing museum, that you were to lead this organization to a whole new phase. So why did you take the job?
Well, I thought it had a lot of challenges, of course, but I think the potential, the opportunities for kind of reinventing and putting the city's museum on everyone's radar was a great opportunity, and that's really what drew me to this museum.
On the face of it, it's going to be quite a challenge because for many people outside of Philadelphia, the city is regarded in itself as a museum. How do you get them away from, or is that the ambition, to get them away from Carpenter's Hall and away from the Liberty Bell?
Not to get them away so much, but what we would really hope to do was make this a prism, if you will, where people come and focus and get an overview of the history of Philadelphia, and then, like a prism, push people out so that they can really see Philadelphia and its history everywhere we look. So we would like to sort of be a focal point from which people could start their journey and then go out and see all of what Philadelphia has to offer.
Many people will know you from your time at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and you worked in tandem with Anne Darnancourt in what to many people was a reinvigoration of that organization. What are the lessons you bring from the Museum on the Hill to this museum downtown, do you think?
First of all, they're different in what they are. One is a fine art museum, and the History Museum has a different idea of collecting. I think the collections here, the 100,000 objects here, have not been seen in a way or displayed in a way that make people understand and are proud of their own history. I think this museum, you talk about lessons I've learned, is really for Philadelphians. My goal would be to have Philadelphians, those who live and work in Philadelphia and the greater region, to come here and learn about the 330-year history of this institution. If you look at the art museum, it's encyclopedic. It's much more international in scope and focused. So I think what I've learned there in a very large way, I hope I can refine and bring to bear here at this museum.
You're very enthusiastic on the idea of participation from the public, a lot of educational programs, and on the homepage of the museum's website, do you have something you'd like to contribute to the museum? You've actually said to the people of Philadelphia, maybe you've got something in the attic that is of value that might help us tell our story.
Absolutely. I think it's funny if you say the city's attic. I think that it has two different kinds of connotations. One could be it's dusty, it's old, it's not of use anymore, so we'll put it in the attic. The other is one of great finds. And sometimes when you go up to the attic and look through an old photograph book that you didn't know you had or from your parents, and especially a city like this that was so strong in manufacturing, whether it's pictures, whether it's books, whether it's objects that were manufactured here in Philadelphia, we'd love to know about it. Not everything will make it into the collection, but let's have a look and let's see if there's a connection, if there's a story that can be told from your object that you have in your own home.
On the second floor, two of the, we won't call them permanent collections because I don't think you want anything to be permanent, but there are two wonderful side exhibitions that you're proposing. One made in Philadelphia. Of course, a lot of people will be aware of Philadelphia's reputation during the 19th century as the workshop of the world. And the other played in Philadelphia, tapping into the great sporting heritage here. Tell us about those.
I think the play between made in Philadelphia, those things that were manufactured here over the years, whether it's Stetson hats or silver or furniture or toys, we have great collections, and that gallery will turn over every few months. The corollary on the other side of the room is played, as you say, in Philadelphia, and the great sporting heritage, if you go back to the Philadelphia A's at the turn of the century. So memorabilia in uniforms, we have Jimmy Rollins from his World Series championship. So this gallery will change based on the season, based on the sport. It could be college sports. We have a great history of college athletics here. So what I like about that, what I think will be very popular, is that you will be able to see the different sporting events. And when we say played, it could also mean music. It could mean broadcast, what was played here in Philadelphia. So I think there are a lot of opportunities, and it gives you an opportunity to look in your attic, whether it's sheet music or whether it's any signed copies of people who indeed performed here in Philadelphia. It's something we'd be interested in.
Final question. Philadelphians, I won't say world-renowned, but Philadelphians are well-known for being down on their city and not
having the degree of pride that people have in other cities around the country and around the world. How much can a museum like this contribute to there being more of a joy about Philadelphians?
I think it can do a great deal, and I'm not a Philadelphian, but having lived here now for 10 years, there almost isn't a day or a week that goes by that I don't discover something new about this city. It's extremely walkable. History is everywhere. And my sense is if we could make this fun, if we can make this interactive, if we can make this an appealing place to bring a family and learn about one aspect of the city's history, then Philadelphians will feel, and I do think they have great pride in the city. There's so much going on here, and particularly when we look at the historic district. So my sense is there will be a great sense of pride. Plus, there will be local stories, people telling their stories. We have a community gallery that we're sitting in right now, in fact, that will be open to organized groups to show their history here every few months. And I think that will give Philadelphians a pride in that various organizations that are all over the city that have not necessarily had an opportunity to display and to talk about what their civic group has done in the city.
Charles Croce, the new executive director of the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. Among its programs prior to reopening in March is Capital City, an exploration of Philadelphia's role as the nation's capital in the 1790s. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.